You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. I'm really excited about the podcast today. It's with Dr. Jeremy Levin, who is Executive Chairman and Founder of Ovid Therapeutics, a public company focused on medicines for epilepsies and seizure-related brain disorders. He's also Chairman Emeritus of Bio. He has a fantastic new book. It's titled Biotech in the Balance, Saving a Strategic Industry in an Age of Distrust. Enjoy the pod. Dr. Jeremy Levin, welcome to the podcast.
Kelly, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So towards the end of your book, you write, quote, "If this book has a single message, it is that biotechnology cannot pretend to be a neutral passenger in an age of distrust," end quote. So I want you to unpack that, of course, for the specific field of biotech, but I also want to suggest that you could say the same thing for almost any industry that exists in the moment we are living in. Is that right?
I think that's such an astute comment. We have many instances through history where industries chose to be quiet. And I think perhaps the rise of and I don't want to go there straight away, but the rise of national socialism in many of the countries in Europe prior to in the 1930s was an example of that. Industries chose to be quiet. And in those instances, by being quiet, they effectively enabled change. And I think that enabling change is of great consequence. And it speaks at the end of the day, it speaks to whether industries see themselves as purely part of the machine to make individuals money, or they feel they are part of the social infrastructure that builds the democratic nation, or the democratic bones of a nation. And for me, there are several pillars of democracy, and one of them is healthcare. And as a part of healthcare is the covenant that exists between industry and patients, where you commit to giving them the best possible thing you can do and being silent when what you do is being rocked is not appropriate.
It's okay. I'm gonna make a leap, but maybe it's not such a leap. So my wife is directing a new show at Second City right now, one of our resident company shows. And, you know, we are a company that does satiric comedy about the world we live in, very much stems out of the sort of Brechtian period of cabaret that existed in that period that you're talking about. And we all know those cabarets didn't stop the evil, but they were trying to address it in some way. And one of the things that my wife Anne has been doing as director of the show has been leaning on the cast to do more improvisation and conversation with the audience. And in fact, the first 15 minutes of the show, before it even really starts, the cast is out talking and mining the audience that's there for that night and that night only for their stories. And as what we've noticed over time is that it's almost like the anti-AI show, in that the people are sharing wild stuff that is true, and you know it's true in terms of the just, you know, feeling it in the room, but also the way we spin it back to them the other evening, two people, they were asked, were like, what's a weird thing that sort of happened in your world? And they said their parents discovered that there was two bodies buried in their backyard. you can't make this up, right? And then the cast just runs with it. And what the connection I'm seeing is what we know in a theater where there's this improvisational thing happening, because is that we have to set the norms and we have to establish mutual trust. Because if they think we're faking it, it's not going to work.
Definitely won't. Definitely.
And I think if there's a similarity between this comedy theater in Chicago that's been doing this for 67 years and what you're talking about is this bond of trust that has to exist for the thing to work.
You know, it's very human. For something to ultimately work, to walk down a path with somebody, you've got to feel that you want to be there, that they're going to be at your side when, let's say, you meet a tiger on that path, mm-hmm. or that you want something to explore together, but you're trusting with them. I think it's an immensely important concept. I would say, however, going back to comedy and what was happening in the 1930s, they were actually the last redoubt. They were the individuals who were trying so very hard before you turned into what was that horror that came to push that back. So I believe that they are part of the sort of intimate inner circle of what we do. And you require that, they don't have the power. Remember, one of the beauties of what happens to art and to music and humor is that it floats. Mm. It floats across all of us. It enters our minds. It does. Its basic power is not a power of force or a power of compelling. It's a power of entrance and a power of change, changing minds a little bit, making life a little bit better. That's different from an industry. An industry has the ability to economically change something, to fundamentally shift a way that behavior occurs. So when those with the levers that actually can work step aside, and you're then left with the moral core, the social essentially breeze, that wonderful breeze that makes life so interesting, then I have to tell you something that tells you a lot about the society and the individuals. They're extraordinarily brave. They are people of great, great consequence.
So what my audience knows is I'm just coming off a medical journey. I had open heart surgery in March. And I want to talk a bit about how the distrust has been earned that's out there. And I remember a moment when I got the email, which was, hey, this is what your surgery is going to cost. And it was like $500,000. And, you know, it's like, what is that number? And of course, that didn't necessarily come out of my pocket exactly. I didn't pay that money. It got paid through insurance because I have that. But it is... I went around and showed it to people because it was like a chill-inducing email, right, when you look at that. And I had a wonderful experience. Everything went great. I loved my doctors. I loved my nurses even more. Doctors were great, though. But in this industry sort of writ large, I think it's very easy to understand why humans would be like, I don't trust it at all.
You know, speaking to what you've just said, I'm a great aficionado and love watching The Pit.
Yes.
I was actually a ER doctor. I know what it means. But in one of the instances, there's a patient who is desperately ill with diabetes, gets repaired, and then is trying to get out of the hospital because it's going to cost $100,000. It's an extraordinary episode. And it teaches you something of what we all feel. The distrust that was built between our industry and the public is not new. It's been growing profoundly. It has grown from the very moment where somebody asked a patient to pay for a medicine. from that moment, the companies that looked at this industry as a business, and let me repeat that, as a business, violated something very fundamental. And that is that, yes, you should get paid for what you do. There is no doubt of that. However, there is a whole difference between saying that you are going to pay for this important life-giving medicine and then ensuring that that person will get that medicine without having to be double punished. One, having the disorder, and two, now feeling the abject fear that they cannot afford it. This gets exemplified and exaggerated all the time in the minds of individuals, rightly so. Because in our society, the concept of a business being the company and the company being a business means that the company has forgotten who its true stakeholders are. The stakeholders are not just shareholders, which is the way companies often behave. They are patients. They are the families. And in that regard, they are even the society we live in. So companies who ignore those other stakeholders and their interests are effectively sometimes very successful because they make great profits and they pay out to shareholders. But they are fundamentally eroding the trust, which requires them otherwise to go out and to combat the intermediaries who are raking off the coals, raking up money from the pocket of the ill people. And there are those are the PBMs, particularly in the medicines environment. It is also those on the boards who are not incentivizing the board, the members of management to pursue novel new medicines rather than pursue revenues, to pursue ensuring that patients stay on the drug, and 40% of them don't at the end of every year, and so they should be encouraged to do that. But instead of doing that, they raise prices. So the revenue stays the same. The problem is you've got nothing new, and the patients are dropping off, and you're just basically churning for dollars as opposed to healing diseases. So this evolution from what is an incredibly meritorious and wonderful industry to one which is seen as exploitative is very, very concerning. And then when you add to this the more recent and deeply concerning, perhaps even potentially fatal, introduction of questioning of scientific fact, you have something which has begun to erode the foundations of the industry. And when I say the eroding of scientific fact, I mean, let's take an example. It means that we now have a huge segment of the United States who believe that vaccines fundamentally cause harm. Well, we can track that right the way back to a completely fallacious, false, and subsequently retracted paper published in a very prestigious journal, who published it knowing it was inaccurate. Now, that took 15 years to rewind. And in that time, huge, huge segments of the population fell into a morass of anguish where they believed vaccines for measles and mumps and rubella caused autism, a sheer nonsense. Not just a sheer nonsense, a proven nonsense. But it has life. Why? Because it was given credibility. And then when you have leaders who start to propound political views on what a medicine should or shouldn't be, you enter into a completely different world, a world of make-believe, a world of fantasy, in a world which is ultimately damaging. And we've seen this before. We've seen this in Soviet Russia. Lysenko destroyed the lives of millions by doing this. with the consent of the Soviet government. Millions died, agriculture plummeted, science vanished. So that distrust is not just on the side of the companies, it is also incumbent upon the leaders of the country and their administrations to ensure that facts are facts. There is a thing called a scientific method. That's why aeroplanes fly. Science works.
And science changes. That's not to say that you don't make, you learn things and it changes. My brother is an architect, and I remember at a certain age, maybe it was like eighth grade, he started gifting me books by Buckminster Fuller and Lewis Mumford. It's not the way I think. I was a writer and an artist and ended up in a theater. But I think the architecture is important because this is a thing you bring up, is that there's this lattice work that everything is built upon. And so when you think about the architecture behind the science, I want you to talk through what this is, because it operates maybe not like a pyramid, but it definitely, you've got universities and research institutes sort of at the bottom, and they're under threat right now, right? I mean, the funding is under threat. My wife is a college professor in addition to a director here, and my dearest friends are in academia, and so going after them at the bottom, you know, is a problem, but that threat continues as you sort of ladder up, correct?
Oh, yes. I think you have to start in a way that describes, Kelly, a basic understanding of what is the science of biotechnology.
Yeah.
This is critical, because without that, everybody says, I don't really understand what you're talking about. And I think the simplest way for person in the street to understand about what biotechnology is, it is the tools and the capability to unpack the living cells, of which you have trillions in your body, that make up the human body and any living body. You unpack it. You understand what are the proteins that work in it. You understand what are the energies that drive it. You understand what foods that cell eats, and then how those cells link together to make organs, and how the organs themselves work together to make the body. Biotechnology has begun to unpack all of that. We're beginning to understand how the tiny little proteins on the surface of a cell can tell within the cell the cell to do something. Let's say, for example, to secrete insulin. So when you tickle it on the outside, boom, out goes insulin. This is really very, very important and fundamental. But before 1973, there wasn't that kind of a science. It was really some work done in San Francisco and elsewhere, but primarily there, which began to unpack that. And once it unpacked, a scientist called Herb Boyer, absolutely bat crazy venture capitalist, said, you know, this is a crazy idea, but let's figure out that maybe by unpacking what the cell is, we can find wonderful new cures. And together they built, by 1976, the first of several key companies, and that company was called Genentech. Now, that company has gone on to be a multi-billion dollar giant. It sells very important medicines. But my point is, it starts from the basic premise, unpacking the cell and how cells work together. So when you come now to what you just said, what occasioned that moment? How could you say I can unpack the cell? Well, it didn't come overnight. It came from decades of work. It came from unseen science. For example, we at the end of the Second World War decided it was worthwhile and important to advance the biological sciences. So we created the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. We created the National Science Foundation. We created a whole set of infrastructure that most people in this country never see, don't know very much about. But it became like, essentially, much like the core of innovation in this country. It started the ball rolling, asking incredibly intricate scientific questions, which slowly, 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 since 1947, built up the body of evidence. It's like building a house. You don't know what the house is going to look like until all the bricks are assembled. You have a plan, you have an idea, but you don't know. And it's like building that house. You built the foundation. You never see that foundation again. Then you built the first walls. That was Genentech. And it was all built on those foundations. At the end of the day, if you start questioning those foundations, that house of science crumbles. Mm-hmm. If you pull out the foundations of science and you say it's not true, there's nothing to build on. So we built academic centers. We built training for incredible scientists. We brought millions of really skilled people from abroad who contributed to this revolution. And we went from one little company, Genentech and Chiron and a couple others, to well over 1,000 today. But what nobody sees is that industry. They don't even see, they see the medicines. Why do they see the medicines? They see them because that industry sells all of its medicines to the pharmaceutical companies, the giants. 70% of all new medicines in our generation come from the biotech industry. It is an unseen industry. It's an industry built on a layered cake of industrial capability, all foundationally in science, the NIH, then the FDA, which is it's the extraordinary body of people who approve and evaluate and approve drugs and say they're safe, and then a whole series of ancillary entities who all allow for innovation to grow. You never see them. You don't even know them. And I would challenge that if you went to somebody in pretty much any city in the United States and says, tell me, what is biotechnology? They wouldn't know. Would they know, however, if they had melanoma, that they might get cured? Would they know if they had a disease called acute myeloid leukemia that they might get cured? All of those cures come from this industry. And all of this industry is built on a foundation which was, up until the last couple of years, rock steady in its belief in science, its recruitment of the best in the world to come and do science here, and beneath that, the commitment of the government to invest, I didn't say spend, I said invest billions of dollars in the health of the nation by building the NIH and academic centers around the world, around the country. So to me, it's that infrastructure that, when rocked, means that we're at consequential risk of losing those new medicines.
There's a line in the book that I highlighted, and it relates really interestingly to like the previous half hour before we started taping. So I ran into my friend Piero, who's a colleague, and we were talking about AI. And one of the things in improvisation is one of our rules, for lack of a better word, is nothing you do is wrong. Because wrong is valuable. And by the way, wrong is usually funny. So it's very, very wrong is very useful. Piero and I worked, along with my wife Anne, with a group at the University of Chicago, these behavioral scientists. We formed a thing called the Second Science Project. It's about a four-year project that looked at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation and vice versa. It was wonderful. And I remember crossing campus once with Heather Caruso, one of the professors, and she was saying to me at the time, one of the things that bothered her was that every time a paper got rejected, that paper was lost forever to the university. She's like, I don't understand why we don't save those papers, because they're so valuable in terms of their mistake or what was wrong and that sort of thing. And it stuck with me. And Piero was just coming out of a corporate workshop that we were leading here for a power company who over the last 2 days wanted Second City to help teach their leaders how to work with failure and be more resilient, but also recognizing that failure is an essential process for innovation. Of course it is. And you write in the book, you say, quote, genuine progress requires a willingness to fail repeatedly and visibly. And I want to say most important, visibly. And it's, we understand the cultural reasons that that's maybe a little scary for people, but at its root, it seems to be of the DNA of anyone who's trying to make something out of nothing, anyone who is trying to do something novel, which is, of course, interesting when we talk about AI, which truly mostly isn't novel because it is just using and looking for predictable patterns. So I don't know if that inspires any thoughts in you.
Well, lots. And, you know, it's really interesting. If you sit on a seesaw, you know how it's going to work.
Yeah.
You can pretty much predict it's going to go up and down. There's no failure to predict there. If you extend that a little bit, in most of engineering, you know when you attach two wheels to an axle, it's going to roll. Biology is not like that. Mm. Biology is infinitely more complex. The good Lord created the cells of the human body in some miraculous fashion. I don't know how it got created, but I do know one thing, that the complexity of any one cell in your body dwarfs, let me repeat that, dwarfs all of the engineering feats of mankind. So you're asking us in a moment, you're asking scientists to unpack that incredibly complex system and to know exactly where they're going. That is not feasible. What they do have to unpack is not just how it works, but where it doesn't work. Because if they don't know where it doesn't work, they're condemned perpetually for going down those routes that don't help you. So experiments that fail are experiments that inform. So long as you are prepared to admit it. And I think one of the most remarkable things about the industry I live in, it is truly remarkable, is that there are hundreds of thousands of scientists who go into the laboratory every day, and I mean every day, with the same smile, the same commitment, they're going to find a medicine. That's what they do. That's their life. That's what motivates them. That's, some people like driving tractors. I do. Other people like going fishing. I do. But yet others like going into a laboratory. And by the way, so do I. Mm-hmm. But when they go in, they know that their experiment has a, not just a high, an extremely high likelihood of failing. But they're doing it so that they can build a real bridge across all of those failures to the right point, to understand why it failed, to learn from it and to take to the next step. And to me, they are the true unsung heroes of the industry, the scientists who go in every day and fail until one day they don't. And when they don't, you and I are the beneficiaries of it. But if they hadn't taken that approach, then I can tell you right now, we would never, ever have any new medicines. We'd be stuck in the years gone by when, yeah, you could slap a bit of mud on a cut and hope that that worked. We'd be in the Stone Age unless you were prepared to consistently fail, unpack ideas, and then to learn from them.
When I was maybe halfway through the book, I was like, this is a really amazing book about ethics in my mind. That's what we were doing. And I'm, if I'm in the realm, in the correct realm of that, did you think you were writing a book about ethics? And even if the answer is yes or no, at what point, what's the chicken and egg on ethics with regard to your work, your industry, this book?
I think it's expressed in one of the phrases I used, and that is that every time I give a medicine to a patient, you know that you've changed their life. Mm-hmm. Unless you have an ethical approach to that, everything you do becomes not just meaningless, but perhaps even immoral. And from my perspective, the crossover between what we do to being ethical requires that we set ourselves a standard which few other industries can be expected or possibly even should hold themselves to. But ours is different. Mm-hmm. Ours is completely different. We are actually in the business of transforming people's lives. And when we do that, that's a whole different story. That's a whole different story.
Yeah. How much of these issues are about the United States as opposed to other parts of the world? You talk in the book, I think, pretty interestingly and convincingly that we both need to recognize we live in a global economy, but also not just, you know, send everything offshore. Proximity is important in terms of these medicines. So when and I can tell from your accent, I'm guessing you weren't born in Minnesota. I think you probably have experience living in other places. So talk a bit about that.
Well, unfortunately for me, I have not been born in Minnesota. I think it must be very wonderful. I've heard wonderful things, and I've visited many parts of it, but it's really lovely. No, I am originally born on a tiny little farm in the middle of the northwestern Cape of South Africa. Mm-hmm. And so I've practiced medicine there. I've practiced medicine in Great Britain, Switzerland, Middle East. So I know what it feels like to have listened to patients from different parts of the world. What's very interesting is that in each part of the world is that it doesn't matter where you are, but the patient expresses gratitude for having changed their life. Now, what differs between the United States and elsewhere is that our system has been built on very different principles. It's been built essentially on principles which were originally designed for other kinds of businesses. So, for example, biotech, this is not talking about patients, this is now talking about the financing of biotech. Biotech simply grew up under the tent of large pharmaceutical companies and was expected to survive in the marketplaces that we have just because that's what everything does. Mm-hmm. However, our marketplace treats finding a medicine as a trade of stock, not of a long-term project. So you have very short-term thinking starts happening in the industry. In the pharmaceutical industry, a very similar type of thinking happens. Elsewhere in the world, that's not necessarily the case. People view finding a medicine as a genuine mission, and they construct their organizations and their countries to deal with that. One of the more remarkable ways where you've seen this is actually China. China is very keen that the health of its people be seen as probably as part of its national strength. So what they've done, they've begun to upgrade enormously every part of their society in regard to that. But they've also built their financing, their ways that they approve drugs, the way that they educate people, the way that they build companies to that end, improving the health of their country. And that has consequences. It means that you see an industry which is now probably going to become the largest producer of innovative new medicines in the world by 2035. In Africa, where they have none of the resources that we have, but immense gratitude for the medicines we produce, immense gratitude. We struggle because sometimes companies say, well, I can't make a profit in Africa. Well, that's part of being a global company. It's not a question of making a profit. It's a question of understanding how the society that you live in will recognize your contribution to other societies. So this is a very complex question, because no one company can bear the consequences of just being the only one to do something. You have to have it as part of your national imperative that you will not just build a strong industry, but you will enable the medicines that it produces to go to those less fortunate in other parts of the world. I do believe that society does have answers for this. We struggle with it. I know we struggle with it. But when you've seen the delight of somebody in Maun in Botswana, who for the first time knows they're going to get drugs that will fight off the tuberculosis, and oh, by the way, that will otherwise kill them, or keep back the HIV, which they'd otherwise spread to dozens of others, and that it all comes from this extraordinary industry in America, then you understand what that really means, that you are part of a global health initiative. And it's incumbent on us to think through how we deal with it. I'm not naive. Companies need to be profitable. But I'm equally determined that we as an industry need to discharge our global responsibilities. And some companies do it incredibly well. Some do it in a way which is highly meritorious. Others simply ignore it, and yet others simply don't touch it.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, you have a line in the book where you say, quote, "I have young colleagues tell me quietly that the only thing keeping them going is whether they still believe the story we tell," end quote. What is the story you're telling, and how true is that story?
What an interesting question. I think it's very important for our industry to understand that it has a purpose, a raison d'être. We are here to better man. We are here to conquer the diseases that have always afflicted mankind. And we have a chance of doing this gradually, progressively, and inexorably. And when you take that as your single most important precept, the thing that drives you, then young people quite rightly say, that's a mission I want to be remembered for. That's something that I want to do. And I believe that that mission still goes on. I believe the vast majority, not all, but the vast majority of my industry firmly believes in that. And when I say my industry, I mean the biotechnology industry. I mean the salespeople who are selling medicines to doctors, and I mean the researchers in the large pharmaceutical industry. I do not mean necessarily the boards and the directors of the large companies who see them as businesses. They are perhaps the minority, but they're a very powerful minority. So I would like them to look at themselves and ask, do we believe that we still have a purpose? Because if we don't, and that purpose is only making money, then you cannot ever expect that incredible scientist, that incredible salesperson, to believe in what they do daily. I believe it, and I would never expect anybody else to think otherwise, because if I could never ask them to do anything if they didn't believe it.
See, I think that disconnect that you're talking about is quite common across different industries. You know, I started here in the late 80s. I started casting young talent in the early 90s. And so I often get brought in to help consult here with, like, what's going on with the young talent today? And I'm like, you know, what I'm recognizing is they are still interested in the things that we're interested in, which is speaking truth to power, which is providing transformation for self and for audiences, which is creating connection, community, and collaboration, all those things. But man, they sniff out the hypocrisy very quickly. They know we're owned by a private equity firm, and they question their values, their ethics, even though this private equity firm in the last few years have owned us have been actually quite ethical in my experience. But they see that hypocrisy elsewhere. They see it at their colleges and where they've come from or if they haven't gone. While I completely understand how important it is in terms of this, you know, what you're dealing with in biotech, it's like, it's not your problem alone.
I know. It's a societal one. Mm-hmm. What can we find a, you know, what built this amazing nation?
Yeah.
All sorts of people coming together to do something remarkable. And somewhere along the line, we have to recapture that spirit.
Yeah. One more line that I really loved in the book. You said this is your 10 commitments for bold biotech industry. One of them was we will treat leadership as a relay, not as a throne. And if I'm thinking about the world that we live in right now, I'm like, I wish I saw that baton in a hand, because that is not there. I see a lot of thrones. I see a lot of gold toilets.
And that is around the world. And I believe every single one of us is better for the fact that we actually, one, recognize that, and two, refuse to allow it to dominate our day to day. And the more we oppose it, the more we make our voices heard, the more that becomes real. And as far as I'm concerned, we're all going to end up in a grave.
Yeah.
Let's at least know that we've done something by the time we get there.
Right. And you can't take it with you. I don't know why, we all know this phrase. Why is that not sinking in? All right. We always ask our guests for a yes and story to end the podcast. I'm very excited to hear what yours might be.
So I said yes to something that I should have said no to when I was at Bristol Myers Squibb. And it was against the backdrop that every single major company, every single major leader in my own company said to me that I should not, under any circumstance, go and seek out the area of immuno-oncology. That is the area that takes the white blood cells and turns them into your first-line defense and offense against cancer. Never before done. Many companies had failed in it. Many companies had basically walked away from the area. And I said, yes, I am going to do this. And despite enormous anguish, then what was wonderful was to watch as all of those who were saying no started to say yes. And the yes translated into something very remarkable. A company which would have failed, Bristol Myers Squibb, would have failed, no question, would have been bought by Wyeth or one of those other giants, suddenly took a deep breath, moved forward, and collectively bought Medarex. A small company that didn't look as if it was anything particularly special, but it had at its core thinking, capabilities, and the potential of this area breaking open. And then to their enormous credit, I should have said no. I should have said, this is ridiculous. We're not doing this. This is everything. Everything tells you that it's not going to work. But to that point that you made earlier on, I asked myself the hard question. Mm-hmm. Should we run the experiment? Right. And the answer was yes.
Sure.
And so we ran the experiment. And going in 2009, from only four clinical trials in the world, 10 years later, 50% of all clinical trials in the industry was focused in this area. More than 50% of all research dollars were focused in this area. But more importantly, we were seeing dramatic and wonderful changes in melanoma, in all sorts of other cancers. And it was a true revolution. So if you want to know the moment I should have said no, but actually said yes, that was it. And the reason for me doing that was going back to those very questions we talked about. You must move forward honestly by asking the difficult question, even if it seems impossible. So I should have said no, and I should have agreed with everybody. But at the end of the day, we all said yes, but it took just, you needed to open the door.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. The book is called Biotech and the Balance, Saving a Strategic Industry in the Age of Distrust. Dr. Jeremy Levin, thank you for coming on the pod.
Kelly, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you and learning from you, by the way.
Getting DSAnd is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.